This is hell.
An anti-austerity revolution may be taking hold across Europe. From Greece to Spain. Here to tell us about that potential revolution, Yanis Varoufakis. He is a member of the Syriza party, running for a seat in the Greek parliamentary elections next Sunday, January 25th. That's a week from tomorrow. Good afternoon, Yanis.
Good afternoon to you and to everyone who is listening.
Thank you very much for being on our show today. I hope I didn't butcher your name too much.
Not too much. You did a pretty good job, given its Greekness.
All right. So we're told by the IMF that unless economies become more austere, cut public funding of services, renegotiate, if not public pensions, cut public sector pay and labor rights, open up their markets to foreign investment, take limits off financial services, that's the only way out of debt and to avoid bankruptcy, which would lead to an economic collapse as the state has simply become unaffordable. Why, in your opinion, is austerity seemingly the only solution that we are ever given for fixing the economies of Europe?
It's a 100% political issue. It's got nothing to do with economics. Since I'm speaking to you from Greece, your question and the IMF position is has been tested in the last 2 years to the full in the experimental laboratory called Greece. Think about it. Greece has had the largest fiscal consolidation in peacetime of any country during the last 300 years. We've cut, cut, and cut. Wages have collapsed by 46%. The state budget has been shrunk by 38%. We have had the most vicious liberalization of the labor market to the extent that effectively there are no controls on employers anymore. They can do as they please. Not formally, but at least in practice. We've had total liberalization, privatization of almost every sector, and of course, banking. And what was the result? The result was that Greece has lost about 28% of its nominal GDP. Youth unemployment has reached 63%. Employment has crashed by one third. And the state is in a state of perpetual bankruptcy. Now, those of us who believe in science and in empirical testing of propositions should take very seriously this exercise in austerity and ask questions about the sensibility of the proposition that you just put forward.
One of the things that I would say the major thing that guides the U.S. view when it comes to Greece is obviously our dominant media. And our dominant media has a litany of stereotypes about Greece and Greeks that almost become racist. The way in which the Greek problem was described here in the United States by our dominant media is that Greeks were Greek public sector workers were overpaid, that their retirement was far too early, that their pension was far too high, and that Greeks made an art of avoiding taxes. So the reason that the Greek economy, according to our dominant media narrative here in the United States, the reason that the Greek economy went under was simply because the Greek government was overspending and the Greek workers were not producing enough. What's your reaction to that stereotype that was repeated over and over and over again here in the U.S. media?
Every huge lie is founded on a plethora of small truths. There are many small truths in the dominant narrative about Greeks. I do not want to defend everything about Greece. There is a lot about Greece that I can't stand personally. It is true that there's been tax evasion, actually tax immunity, like in the United States as well, right? It is true that the public sector was public sector workers were not overpaid. They underproduced, and they underproduced because the Greek state was hopelessly inefficient. I can go on with a litany of such malignancies that characterize and typify the Greek social economy. But none of that explains the crisis that we find ourselves in. Greece was like that for the last 150 years. The reason why you and I are talking about Greece is because we have had a systemic crisis in Europe. And Greece, for the reasons that we just discussed, was perhaps the canary in the mine. It was the weakest link of the chain, but it's not responsible for the chain reaction. Even if Greece was not part of the European monetary union, the systemic crisis of the Eurozone would still be at hand, and it would still be unraveling and creating a great deal of havoc for the international economy. Let me put it very simply. Before the crisis, before Lehman Brothers, right, what we had in Greece and in the rest of the European periphery was what I call Ponzi growth. You can understand what Ponzi growth is. It's a very well understood term. It's growth based on increasing, accelerating, unsustainable borrowing. And then when Lehman Brothers went under and we had the credit crunch internationally, that money disappeared, those loans dried up, and the bubbles burst from Ireland and Spain all the way to Greece. And then we moved to the second phase, from Ponzi growth to Ponzi austerity. The problem, I don't have a problem with the idea of an austere life. You know, the idea that people actually are careful with their money and they put some money aside and they pay for their children's education instead of paying for a Mercedes-Benz wagon or whatever. That's all great as far as I'm concerned. The problem is that we don't have austerity. We have what I call Ponzi austerity. In other words, austerity, which is kept alive by means of ever-increasing unsustainable debt. If you look at Greece over the last 4 years, we've had all this cutting. We had all this austerity in the form of reduced wages, pensions, state benefits, and all that. Do you know what happened to our public debt? It went up from 120% to 175%. We borrowed the largest sum in human history as an insolvent nation, on condition that we will shrink our income. Now, that's not austere. That's not a way of living in an austere Protestant fashion, right? This is highly exuberant, highly spendthrift, and highly the opposite of what austerity should be. And the only reason why this is happening is because, of course, these loans are not to be used for the purposes of digging Greece out of a hole or saving Greece. This is a cynical transfer of losses from the books of the banks, primarily Northern European banks, onto the shoulders of the taxpayers. And this, they have the audacity to refer to as austerity.
So I want to ask you real quick about tax evasion. There are so many questions I wanted to ask you because your reply was fantastic, Yanis, and I really appreciate you being on the show. But let's just talk about tax evasion just for a second. When I was reading about you and doing some research on your work, one of the things that I kept thinking about, I kept seeing that term tax evasion, tax evasion, tax evasion. And I kept thinking, why do I have a feeling that tax evasion was an art, not by the poorest of the people who are now paying for the bailing out of the banks, but by the richest of the people? Was tax evasion something that was done simply by the most powerful and the most wealthy? Are we blaming the poorest in Greece for a strategy that was embraced mostly by the richest?
Absolutely, to such an extent that it wasn't even tax evasion. It was immunity from taxation. They had found ways, legally, of never paying any tax. They had offshore companies. You know, you go to the suburbs of northern Athens, which are splendid and leafy. You see mansions with swimming pools, tennis courts, and all that. They pay hardly any tax because they all belong to offshore companies. And it is as if those mansions are not in Greece. And it is as if they are in no man's land because they are not paying tax anywhere else either. On top of that, you have transfer pricing by large corporations, making sure that they declare losses in Greece, even if they are profitable, because through transfer pricing, they are ensuring that, to make it simple, they have some kind of postbox company in the Cayman Islands or even in Luxembourg, for that matter. And even if, let's say, they have $100 million worth of profits in Greece, and then they buy a piece of paper could be, you know, toilet paper, from their box office company in Luxembourg for $101 million, then they have a loss in Greece, they pay no taxes. So, you know, under those circumstances, I can assure you that the weaker members of Greek society felt less guilty if they managed to avoid paying 23% general sales tax. Now, that is, you know, sort of a rate that is punitive. So this is what happens. You introduce tax immunity for the powerful and the mighty, and that corrupts the whole body politic. And the weakest people who have to live on $400, $500 a month in a country which is more expensive than the United States of America. The cost of living is higher in Greece than it is in the United States, believe it or not. So you can imagine trying to live, eke an existence for $500 a month or euros a month. And to make ends meet, when you go into a little shop, a corner shop, where the shopkeeper is also struggling under a lot of taxation from the state, because the state has to get its taxes from somewhere, so it gets it from the little people, these two people transact under the table and pay no taxes. And you know what? It is their duty to themselves and to their families to do so, because it's the only way of surviving. So the problem is the kleptocracy. Sadly, this crisis, instead of being a great opportunity to cleanse this situation and to get rid of the kleptocracy and to make them pay, the bailout money that we've been getting from our European partners and from the International Monetary Fund is being utilized primarily to build another kleptocracy. So now we have new magnates owning banks that are bankrupt, that borrow on behalf of the state from our partners. These borrowings weigh down the average weak taxpayer. On the basis of that money, the bankrupt bankers, sponsor bankrupted media, which propel and disseminate toxic propaganda, which is a form of discursive terrorism to the population prior to an election, so that the population votes in a way that is consistent with the interests of these kleptocrats. And the whole thing is given another spin.
So, Lehman Brothers, a lot of people say that, you know, it isn't all the stereotypes that I was mentioning. It isn't because tax evasion, it isn't mostly because tax evasion was an art form. It isn't mostly because the pension system was too big. It wasn't mostly because public sector workers were retiring at an early age or being overpaid. A lot of people, as you were saying, blame the banking sector, blame Lehman Brothers for essentially stealing the money from Greece. And that's what led to the collapse of Greece. Is there any way that Greece could get that money back? Because here in the U.S., amongst the left, amongst progressives, a lot of people always point towards Iceland and saying no to the bailouts, and how that was, at least in the viewpoint here in the U.S., was a major success. Can you, if the Syriza party gets in power next Sunday in the parliamentary elections, can you simply say no to the banks and the bailouts and the debt that has already been accrued by this country of Greece?
It's exactly what we plan to do. The very simple, short word, beginning with an N and ending with an O, is going to be our nuclear weapon. And it's a nuclear weapon that we are going to be ready to use against this vicious cycle that leaves corpses in its wake and a great deal of human misery, and which in the end only solidifies and reinforces the misanthropes, the bigots, the racists, the Le Pens in France, and the Golden Dawns in Greece. But let me take you up on what you said about Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers has very little connection to Greece. The problem here in Europe was the German and the French banks, which were connected to Lehman Brothers, of course, but let's not take that chain too far. Here in Europe, we had the banks from the surplus countries. Surplus within a monetary union means selling more than you are buying from other countries. That also means there is a capital flow into your country. If you sell more than you buy, so that's typical, a typical example is Germany, lots of capital flows into the banks of Frankfurt and accumulates in those banks. There's nothing that bankers hate more than idle money in their banks. So they need to lend it out. The German public and economy was not interested in borrowing these huge reservoirs of cash. So they had to dump it somewhere else. And they dumped it in the periphery. Why? Because the periphery was starved of capital, of funds, for anything from you know, mortgages to some consumption spending to investment in small businesses and so on. So Deutsche Bank, Finance Bank, took all these reservoirs of capital and dumped them on the Irish, on the Spanish, on the Greeks, and so on. This flow of capital from Germany and from France to some extent to our countries created huge rallies in asset prices. That created a semblance of growth and made people feel that they were getting richer. So they got credit cards, they started spending more money. There was this Ponzi growth period. So the reason why we are in the state we are now in was because, of course, it is the fate of Ponzi growth to die, and to die suddenly, as it happened in 2008. And then what happens is you have debt deflation. The banks go bankrupt, the developers go bankrupt, the state goes bankrupt because economic activity drops, the tax state goes down, the state pays more money on unemployment benefit and so on. And then what they do is, in an environment where the private sector is deleveraging, the public sector comes in and introduces austerity. It cuts spending, so private spending, public spending, the sum of that comes down. What is the sum of that? It's national income. So national income shrinks, the debt doesn't shrink. We enter into a situation where we are more and more indebted with less and less money that deters investment, and that gives the whole process a very vicious dynamic. And until and unless somebody says no to this Ponzi austerity where we keep borrowing while cutting, we are going to end up in a postmodern 1930s. And we know what very, very well who benefits from that kind of Great Depression. It's the Nazis, it's the bigots, and it's the racists.
So are you then saying that there is a structural problem within the EU that may make it unsustainable? Because it seems like the policy that you're describing is something that undermined one of the economies within the European Union. Is this one of the areas that you would have the European Union address if you got in office?
You're precisely right. The way we created the Eurozone back in the late 1990s, did two things. Firstly, it removed all shock absorbers. And secondly, it ensured that when the shock comes, it will be gigantic. A five-year-old understands that this is a problem and that you are simply asking for trouble. And when the trouble comes, there's nothing you can do. You don't have the shock absorbers by which to absorb the shock. And to try to do this through cutting and through more borrowing is simply extending and pretending. The worst banking practices ever, writ large, on the canvas of the whole of the European Union. So either we are going to have to reform the Eurozone and the European Union, or I'm very much afraid, and I'm saying this in all the sincerity as a committed European, Europe is going to fragment. It's already fragmenting, but it will fragment to such an extent that you folks on the other side of the Atlantic, you're going to have a very serious job in your hands trying to contain the after effects.
Do you think Europe is better off or worse off than with the euro?
Far worse off. But this is a very important point. I was actually campaigning against the euro in the 1990s, and I was thought of as an eccentric left-wing idiot. But, you know, sometimes the village idiot knows better. So anyway, the point I want to make, and this is a very important point, we shouldn't have created the eurozone. I don't have a problem with a common currency. You know, you have a common currency from California to Delaware and from Hawaii all the way to Texas, and it works very well. So it can work very well. I'm all for a common currency, but you know, you need to structure it in such a way that it can absorb shocks and it can create what I call surplus recycling in order to make the whole union operate efficiently and in favor of the people, not against the people. So we didn't do that in Europe. Now, the problem is this, and this is something I'm trying to impress upon, you know, and any audience that is interested in hearing me. It's one thing to say we should not have entered into the euro, we should not have created it, and it's quite another to say that we should get out of it. If we try to get out of it, we are not going to go to the place that where we would have been had we not entered it. That path simply doesn't exist, and we will fall off a cliff. So those of us who despise the euro, I think we have a moral duty to try to fix it. Because when it fragments, and it may very well fragment and die, it is the weakest members of our society that will suffer the most. There's going to be a terrible fragmentation. Fault lines will appear on the European continent, somewhere along the Rhine and the Alps, with the whole of Europe east of the Rhine and north of the Alps falling under the spell of a new Deutschmark, where there's going to be a lot of recession, a lot of unemployment, but a stable currency, and the rest of Europe, where you're going to have stagflation, if you remember the 1970s, high inflation and high unemployment. Nobody wants that. This will be detrimental to everyone, except for a few spivs who, you know, like the cockroaches after the nuclear disaster, managed to survive and prosper. The crushing majority of Europeans, and indeed, may I say, the whole of the world, are going to suffer from that. So we need to urgently to fix it. But the only way of fixing the euro is for a government like the one we will form, we hope, next week, to say no to the inanity that presents itself as, sort of intelligent, technocratic economic policy.
How much is there a growing anti-austerity movement in Europe? And the reason that I ask is you now have a counterpart in Spain. There's a political party there called Podemos that is very much along the same anti-austerity platform that you have. Henry Giraud of McMaster's College, who was on our show last week, he was discussing Podemos. And then around, I think it was December 23rd through 28th, there were anti-austerity protests in Kiev, Ukraine, which were not covered here in the U.S. whatsoever, because that certainly wouldn't fall into the narrative of the U.S. being in support and our dominant media being in very much in support of the new government in Kiev, and that the people who are on the Maidan are certainly not going to be protesting against it. So how much do you think that there really is a growing anti-austerity movement, or is this just a temporary anomaly that once the economies suffer a little bit under an anti-austerity movement, all of a sudden the same old people are going to be coming back in power?
I'm no prophet, but I can tell you this. As you mentioned Podemos in Spain, there are similar movements even within established parties. In Italy, for instance, the Democratic Party, there's been a movement within it, which is anti-austerity. We have a chance now with the Greek election next Sunday to create a glimmer of hope in Europe that will then become infectious throughout Europe. Because, you know what, if we fail, because the policies that are being pursued now are unsustainable anyway, it's not a question of willpower or political will, they are going to fail. If we, the left, fail to create a humanist pro-European narrative that replaces the existing neoliberal idiocy with an alternative that actually works for the peoples of Europe and turns the European Union from what it has become, which is an iron cage, into a realm of shared prosperity, the only people that are going to rise up and who will adopt anti-austerity narratives as well are the neo-fascists. If you listen to Marie Le Pen, who is the leader of the National Front, the racist National Front in France, and if you simply separate what she says on the economy and on the euro, she sounds splendid. She has all the right arguments. You know, the devil has the best of tunes. And they so happen to be tunes that I sing as well, along to when it comes to a criticism of austerity. And this is terrible. This is awful. This is a repetition of the 1920s and 30s. Let me say this, it may shock some of our listeners. If you take a Joseph Goebbels speech from 1926 and you isolate some paragraphs that are critical of German capitalism at the time, they were absolutely spot on. You see, we tend to think of the Nazis just as monsters, which of course they were. They were crazy, and we contemporaries of ours fail to understand why it is that they rose to power. The reason why they rose to power was that in the midst of their mad, racist, bigoted, misanthropic narratives, there were elements of speaking truth to power regarding the failings of capitalism. Now, we have the same thing here in Europe. Even here in my country, we have the most vile of Nazi parties called Golden Dawn. If you look at some, isolate some sentences that they're critical of austerity, so they're sentences that I could use. And this frightens me, because I know that if we, the left, the progressive humanist left, if we fail, these are the people that will rise up. And it won't just be me and you that end up in the concentration camp. It will be the whole society. And primarily, of course, the migrants who are already being, you know, being on the receiving end of attacks, of verbal abuse, of discrimination. This is a dirty war for the integrity and soul of Europe.
You have an amazing post at your blog, and that is your modest proposal for the way in which the Eurozone and the Greek economy could be reformed. In that, you talk about how people are offered so many false choices. And it reminded me of a conversation we had on the air here with Slavoj Žižek back in October and how these false choices keep being offered to the public. You believe that at stake in next Sunday's January 25th elections is, quote, Europe's integrity, democracy's delicate fabric, the prospect of averting the emergence of postmodern 1930s, and a chance to reclaim our continent as a locus of shared prosperity. So I hate to give you another false choice, but why not? Are Greece's and Europe's choices either slipping toward fascism or sliding towards socialism? Are those the two choices?
We're very far off from sliding towards socialism. Let's face it, I am a committed left winger. I've been a left winger since I remember. That creates a major responsibility to me to accept the failings of the left of the past. We have produced, in the name of humanism, a great deal of inhumanity. And we have never recovered from that failure of the past. We are nowhere near convincing even ourselves that we have a viable socialist economic model. We must create one, because this is why I'm a left-winger. I believe that in the end, we do have, as you said, I'll put it slightly differently, the way Rosa Luxemburg put it, we have a dilemma between socialism and barbarism. But we're not there yet. At the moment, and you mentioned the modest proposal, the reason why it's modest is because it's not socialist, really. What it tries to do is to stabilize capitalism, because, you know, if capitalism gets destabilized, it's not the left that benefits. It's not socialism springs out of it. In the 1920s and 30s, you know very well what sprang out of the destabilization of capitalism. And back then, the left was much stronger, much more powerful, and was occupying a higher moral ground than it has been since then. So as far as I'm concerned, we need to take it one step at a time. First, we need to create a broad coalition with rational people who are not sharing our left-wing traditions, but who do share the fear that democracy, bourgeois democracy, liberal democracy, is being jettisoned. And that we need to end this vicious cycle from austerity to authoritarianism and from authoritarianism to greater depression. Once we stabilize that, our peoples and ourselves will hopefully get a chance to recreate a vision of socialism that will eventually prevail.
One last question for you, Yanis. We have been speaking with Yanis Varoufakis. He is a member of the Syriza party running for a seat in the Greek parliamentary elections next Sunday, January 25th. That's a week from tomorrow. Yanis is professor of economics at the University of Athens and visiting professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson Graduate School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is 2011's The Global Minotaur: America, Europe, and the Future of the Global Economy. You can read Yanis's blog, Thoughts for the Post-2008 World, at yanisvaroufakis.eu. Just go to our website, click on his name, and it takes you directly to his page. Yanis, one last question for you, and it's the question from hell. It's the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience will hate your response. You are running for a parliamentary seat. Syriza Party is running, hopefully, for a much larger, as far as you're concerned, for a much larger representation within the Greek parliament next Sunday, January 25th. Why did Syriza lose in the past, and what would explain a change in popularity of Syriza within the polls?
Well, that's not such a hellish question.
All right, then.
Let me tell you why. If you look at the previous electoral results, Syriza was a small, tiny, left-wing, ecological coalition in the fringes of Greek politics. We were happy to get 4% of the vote and a couple of members of parliament here and there. A typical left-wing rainbow coalition that you would be familiar with in the United States and California, here or there. And suddenly, there was a historical moment that we didn't design, we had not anticipated. It just hit us like 1929 changed the world, 2008 changed the world, and then 2010 in Greece, because everything comes to Greece later, destroyed the Greek economy, and in the process caused the implosion of the political scene. The Socialist Party, which was a social democratic party that had, by the late 1990s, sold its soul to the devil, if you know what I mean, had in 2009, they enjoyed 46% of the vote. 46% of the vote. Do you know where they're languishing now? At less than 3%. So suddenly there was a jolt to the political scene, and we were thrust on center stage. So from 3% in 2012, within a month, we went to 30%. We didn't win. We came very close to winning, but even coming close to winning in 2012, it was a miracle. It was, imagine a small rainbow coalition in the United States going from nothing to 30% of the vote over a few months. You can imagine the effect of that on everybody's spirit and soul. In the last 2 years were 2 years of consolidation and of the evolution of the party from a protest rainbow coalition into a party of government. This is not a simple evolutionary path. It's mired and mined, landmined, I should say. But I think we've done a pretty good job. And what do I mean by that? There's always a danger that when you grow from 3% to 30% and 35% and you become a party of potential, a potentially governing party, there is always a danger that you become co-opted by the establishment, that instead of changing the world changes you. We haven't done that. We've become more sensible. We've become more coherent in our thinking. We've managed to temper our tone, but not sell our soul.
You know, Yiannis, I just got to tell you, I wanted to share this one thing with you. A friend of mine has moved to Greece just recently within the last month or so. And the reason that they moved to Greece is because they feared that there was going to be a global economic collapse and they wanted to be somewhere outside of the United States when that happened. It was kind of a conspiracy theorist kind of thing. So how much safer are they in Greece if there's a global economic collapse than being here in the U.S.?
We're in the interconnected world. I am personally an internationalist. No place is an island. We are all in this together, and we should all struggle together for what is good and decent.
So not even Crete is an island?
Not even Crete.
Yiannis, I really appreciate you being on the show with us this morning. People should check out your blog on a regular basis. Thoughts for the post-2008 world. We have a direct link to it at the front page of our website. Really a pleasure having you on the show with us this morning. It's great to have a perspective that we do not get to hear in the dominant media here in the U.S. Thanks so much for being on our show this morning.
I can assure you the pleasure was mine.
Thank you very much, Yiannis.